There was a man back in the 1800s that was attending public school as a child, and when his mother was called in by the teacher for a conference, she told the mother that her son was addled and that he just didn't function at all well in school and he had no future. And the mother was furious over that, took her son out of school and started teaching him herself. Well, the son started playing around with all sorts of chemicals, and one time almost burned down the house. Another time, when he was working for the railroad, he almost burned up a baggage car. And, you know, he sounds like someone who just wasn't on a fast track to anywhere, pardon the pun. But his name was Thomas Alva Edison. And he went on to have more inventions, more patents than any other American, even more than Letourneau. Imagine that. And the curse that was placed upon him by the teacher because he wasn't able to follow her instructions was one that ultimately did not pan out. Human prophecies accomplish nothing unless they're backed up by God. As we look at Genesis chapter 9, there is a prophecy that is made by a man. It's made by Noah. But that prophecy has force because God is behind it. And yet we look at Genesis chapter 9 and we say, oh, how unfair. One young man, actually probably wasn't so young at that point, but one fellow had one slip up and his whole lineage was cursed forever. And we look at it and we say, wow, you know, the worst nightmares of what the Calvinists tell us about the Bible seem to be true. Curses get placed on people and they can't rise out of it. I think we had better take a new look at Genesis chapter 9. Because these urban legends about what the Bible means just live on and on. Yes, we have a text that in some ways is a tough text, but tough texts require us to look at them closely to figure out what is said, what is not said, what it means, and what it doesn't mean. Now, within the book of Genesis, we have seen that this is a book of life and death. We think back to the first Toledot, the first section of the book, where we have creation and what came out of those 6 days of creation after which God rested. God accomplished in that first section, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 through 2-3, a creation that he could pronounce upon it. Not only was it good, but it was very good. And besides that, he was able to rest on the seventh day because what he had done was complete and needed nothing to be added to it. Well, what happens when man becomes involved? The second Toledot in the book is Genesis 2:4 through 4:26. And it starts with a recap in more depth of Genesis, of the sixth day of creation. During the sixth day, God made the first negative pronouncement of the whole Bible. And that was not good that the man should be alone. It was not good for God to have just created Adam. Was there anything wrong with Adam? No. But Adam needed a helper corresponding to him, or else the earth would never be filled with people, would it? And you remember how we saw on the fifth and sixth days, there wasn't a population explosion. And as God filled the earth, as it was spoken, it meant that he put those that could reproduce themselves among people, land animals, birds, and sea creatures. Okay, so God said when he has looked at man being created, but no woman, it's not good for man to be alone. So then he created the woman, and his pronouncement, which we saw recorded in the first holidote, was that it was very good. But then, humanity fell into death and sin by eating from the wrong tree. And as humanity is plunged into death while the woman is in her first pregnancy, that child, Cain, who she thought was seed of woman, turned out instead to be the murderer of his brother. What God has done that's very good, it doesn't take long with man being involved in it, plunges downward. We have the third toledot, Genesis 5, 1 through 6, 8. Chapter 5 starts out with genealogies. Genealogies, someone's born, they have children, they die. Everyone in that genealogy except one. Who was that? Enoch. Enoch was the only one that didn't die. Everyone else in that genealogy was born, and they died. Well, then, things, you know, you think, okay, well, you know, this isn't looking all that hopeful. Human race just keeps dying, just keeps dying. Well, then it gets pretty bad in chapter 6 because we have the angelic infiltration trying to make it so that the human race becomes contaminated, messing up, potentially, the promises that God had made to Adam and to others. So, that brought us to the statement that amongst all of humanity, there was one man, Noah, who found grace in the Lord's eyes. But then the Lord, in the next toledot, chapter 6, verse 9 through 9:29, which we're going to finish tonight. That toledot, the creation that God has made, that he evaluated as being very good, he repented that he had created it and determined that he needed to destroy it. All except 8 people. So God used a universal flood to judge humanity, which had become corrupt and violent, but delivered Noah and his immediate family to start over in repopulating the earth, with which God covenanted not to flood, no universal flood ever again. But God covenanted to provide for creation to procreate and to exact a penalty for encroaching on God's domain of taking human life. Noah is set up as the second Adam. You may have heard people say, Jesus isn't just the second Adam, he's the last Adam. There's never anyone to succeed him. But when you look at Noah, he is being set in many ways into a parallel situation where he is given parallel commands. He's told to be fruitful and multiply, and God has put his blessing to make it so that Noah has every possibility of things going well. And we're going to find out what happened as Noah gets started on planet Earth after the flood. Things look so promising. And yet, we get into chapter 9, starting with verse 18, and we again see cursing. The first section of this treatment that I have, though, is going to be a momentary digression. You might wonder, why am I going into a digression now? It's because I decided it would be better to do it here than to do it in the middle of the message. So we're going to, on page 2, do an excursus. When we have summary statements of the progeny, the children that resulted from one person's life or one couple's life, the Bible doesn't necessarily order them in birth order. You know, normally if you say all of the children in family, you list them in order. You don't do it haphazardly and start at the last one and work your way forward, or start in the middle and go back and forth. Usually people start out at the beginning. But we're going to find out that in the book of Genesis, Moses has a particular fondness for not listing children in their birth order. And so I'm going to give you an illustration. Look at Genesis chapter 11, verse 26. Now Terah lived 70 years and begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now we look at the first statement of the next Toledot. These are the generations of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begot Lot. Okay, so notice both times it lists them in the order of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So people have looked at that and have assumed that Abram was the eldest, and Nahor was in the middle, and Haran was the youngest. Well, let's look at a couple of passages. Look at Genesis chapter 12, verse 4. You remember the point where God first started speaking with Abram, where was he? He was in Ur of the Chaldees. Now, as we look here at verse 4 of Genesis 12, so Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Okay, now just so you don't get confused, there was a son of Terah named Haran, and there's a city named Haran. So there are two things here that are called Haran. So the Haran that's being spoken of is a city. How old was Abram when he left Haran? 75. Now, look at Genesis 11:32, back up a couple verses. So the days of Terah is Abram's father, were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So he died in the city of Haran. Now we have to go to the New Testament to find a detail that we might infer from the Old Testament, but we wouldn't know it for sure from the Old Testament. But Acts tells us conclusively in Acts chapter 7, verse 4, that Abram did not leave Haran until after his father had died. So in Acts chapter 7, 4, then he, Abram, came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran, and from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which you now dwell. So you'll see a little mathematical problem in the middle of the page. 205 is Terah's age at death, and then Abram was 75 years old when he left the city of Haran, but he left there after Terah had died. So when we subtract it out, it means that the youngest that Terah could have been when Abram was born was 130. Now, back up to Genesis chapter 11, verse 26. Now Terah lived 70 years and begot Abram. Okay, notice No, what it's saying is he started begetting children at that age, but clearly Abram was not the firstborn. Why doesn't Moses like to put them in birth order? He puts them in terms of the order of how crucial they are to the unfolding of the biblical record. Abram is a lot more important than either Nahor or Haran. The only important thing that is recorded in the Bible about Haran is that he had a son named Lot. And you remember how Abram had to rescue Lot later on? Well, you might wonder, why is he interested in Lot? Well, Lot is his nephew. So, notice how we can look at this passage and think, we can jump to the conclusion that Abram is the oldest, and Moses, as it turns out, doesn't usually like to list children in birth order. He has another reason for the order that he puts people. He'll put the most important first, and he'll put the least important last, and it doesn't matter what the birth order is. Okay? Commercial break. We went through this because there's going to be a major interpretive issue in the passage that we're going to be considering. It is an issue of huge consequence that most people have assumed that a certain person was the youngest child of a certain man. And they draw a lot of conclusions based on that. And I think from the way the passage is arranged, instead of that man being the youngest, he's the oldest. And if he's the oldest, a lot of those conclusions that people have drawn about the passage we're going to be looking at will need to be re-examined. So does it make sense here of what I'm saying, that when you see a listing like Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran, that it's not necessarily telling us the birth order? That's going to be important. Okay, so conclusion. Progeny are not necessarily listed in birth order. And that's important for us to notice because, yeah, it's just our expectation. They're going to list them in their birth order. Okay, page 3. Genesis 9, verses 18 and 19 give a setting. It's something that we already could figure out a large proportion of it, even if these verses were not included. But it's reminding us of the setting, and it gives us one additional detail. Verse 18. Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. Well, since you have eight people in the ark, and three of them are Noah's sons, it's pretty logical. These are the people out of whom the genealogy of the whole human race has developed for everyone that's here since the flood. The one detail that's a new one that we have not yet heard is that Ham was the father of Canaan. So he's mentioning a detail, because within this narrative, there's going to be something that's going to be said about both Ham and his son, Canaan. So let's now go down to verses 20 through 23. And this paragraph can be summarized. Upon seeing Noah naked and in a drunken stupor, Ham was disrespectful. But Shem and Japheth, better cross out Ham, that's Japheth, respectfully covered their father's nakedness. Now verses 20 through 21 will set up some of the background information. So let's look at those two verses. And Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. The way that I would summarize those two verses, after planting grapes, Noah became drunk and lay naked in his tent. Now, when it says that he began to be a farmer, the phrase that's rendered to be a farmer would actually be a man of the earth, a man of the Adama. And you remember how Adam was named Adam because he was taken from the Adama? He was taken from the dirt, and so he was named dirt. He was named Adam because he came from the dirt. Well, Noah is a man of the earth. Very important. Was not Adam put in charge of creation? Wasn't he told to subdue the earth? Wasn't he told to be fruitful and multiply? Kind of looks like Noah is following a role that is similar. Because here he is, the head, the human head of humanity at that point, and he is a man of the earth. He's in charge of not only his field, he's the man in charge of the whole earth. How many other people could claim the title of being in charge of the earth? He's it. And he planted a vineyard. Well, we need to look a little bit at the chronology here. And the question is, how long is it after the flood that Noah became drunk? Well, the first question is, did it take him a long time to experiment and find out that grapes they don't remain like Welsh's for very long? They get a little stronger after a while? Or was it something he already knew about? Well, the Bible doesn't tell us. But the word wine hasn't come up yet in the text. So a lot of people say, well, he didn't have a clue about what would happen with grapes, and so it was by accident that he got drunk. I'm not so sure. I have this strong suspicion that he knew that planting grapes would have the desired effect that he wanted. But let's think here a little bit about chronology. Remember when we looked at the passage concerning the flood, we saw that from the time that Noah entered the ark until the day that he left the ark was 377 days. So it was approximately 1 year that he was in the ark. It is not, if you plant grapes, it's going to be 3 years until harvest. You know, that's first crop you're going to be able to pick. You know, you have grape seeds, you put grape seeds in, you're looking at 3 years before you're going to be able to harvest anything. So we think about this, the length of time between when Noah entered the ark until the point that he could have grapes to harvest is going to be at least a 4 year period of time. And we think, what was it that prompted God to bring the flood in the first place? Remember how we had that angelic infiltration into the human race seeking to compromise God's promise that he had made of life. Let's assume that Noah is harvesting his grapes and he has wine only 4-5 years after God has brought judgment upon the whole planet and has destroyed all the people but 8. Well, that's going to play into the passage that we are considering tonight. That's a very short interval between the time that God has judged a world that has become contaminated and has become violent, and every thought and intent of people's heart is bent on evil, and they're essentially undoing what God had set out to do in creation. And only 4, maybe 5, maybe a little longer years after God brings the judgment, then we have the event that happens here. That short timetable between when God judged the earth and for what he judged it is going to be of rather significant point here. Let's look at Genesis chapter 10, verse 1 and 10, verse 6. We have a new Toledot starting here. These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood. Now let's drop down to verse 6. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. We know now that we shouldn't look at verse 6 as telling us automatically that Canaan was the youngest. He may not have been the youngest. My personal suspicion is that he is the eldest. So as we look at this passage, what we are able to say is that a short period of time after God has judged the earth and has delivered Noah, one who found grace in God's eyes, and we pointed out that that's not an accidental statement when the Bible speaks of him finding grace. He was a man who, if he had not found grace, probably would have deserved the same judgment that everyone else got in the flood. Noah, I would say here in this passage, has two difficulties. He has become drunk, which is something that the Bible never condones. And the nakedness that is spoken of here, we're going to find that that's a rather genteel way of saying something that's opening the door for a lot of other problems. So at this point, Noah, the man who has found grace in God's eyes, has set up a situation that's going to be the downfall of one of his sons. I don't think Noah had any idea that his drunkenness was going to result in as big a set of changes as it did. Just like the person who has a little too much drink and gets behind the wheel isn't planning to have an accident, isn't planning to have anything go wrong. Noah wasn't planning for the problems to develop that developed, but his drunkenness set up an opportunity, and that opportunity developed into a problem. Now, just to make a note here, we have observed, I've asserted that the Bible does condemn drunkenness. We have passages like Ephesians 5:18, and there are others. The Bible does not forbid the consumption of alcohol, but it does forbid drunkenness. There was not a problem with Noah enjoying wine. That wouldn't have been a problem, but his drunkenness did set up a situation. Well, let's now see what develops out of this. There's a response by the children, and that response becomes the major feature that is commented upon here within the passage. Verse 22, we see the response of Ham, and then verse 23, Shem and Japheth. Ham was disrespectful, but Shem and Japheth were respectful. Verse 22, and Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. Now, this nakedness here that's mentioned is a rather discreet way of regarding this. Nothing explicit is said here, but in a little bit we'll take a look at a passage in Leviticus and we'll see the types of things that are described by nakedness, or it's a suggestive passage. It is not an explicit passage in some ways, but in verse 22, Ham goes into the tent. Whether he was invited or whether he took it on his own initiative, we're not told, but he went in. And he reports it to his brothers. But there's a rather interesting thing in verse 23. It's not set forth as just a garment in general, but it's the garment, apparently the garment that Noah himself had worn. The picture that I get out of this is Ham went in, and he comes out, and he's parading his father's garment, and he's saying, "Hey, look at what I've got. Guess what about Dad?" And he starts broadcasting. When we think, what was planet Earth judged for maybe 4 or 5 years earlier? They were judged in part because of what had happened when angels tried to infiltrate the human race, and you remember they were taking harems. There was a lot of sexual debauchery that was going on, and Noah is being given an opportunity as a new Adam to start once again on planet Earth. And what happens? Among the 8 people that are delivered, someone's giving hints of saying, "Hey, let's have a party. Let's go back to the way things were about 4 or 5 years ago. Hey, you know, things have been kind of dull here. We were in that ark for a whole year. It was rather dull. And we get the impression here that Canaan is giving indication that his interests aren't going in the same direction as God's interests on these things. Notice it just uses the word nakedness. Let's look at another book written by the same man, written by Moses, and if we think about it, the book of Genesis is written to Israelites as they have left Egypt and they are being prepared to enter Israel. They have been given the Ten Commandments and they are being prepared to enter into the land. So Moses is able to use his normal descriptions and be discreet to talk about things that might not be so pleasant, might not be so nice. Leviticus chapter 18, starting with verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. According to the doings of the land of Egypt where you dwell, where you dwelt, you shall not do. And according to the doings of the land of Canaan where I am bringing you, you shall not do, nor shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances to walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. I am the Lord. None of you shall approach anyone who is near of kin to him to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord." Now, does this sound a little bit like the passage we just looked at in Genesis? Well, let's read a little further. Verse 7. "The nakedness of your father or the nakedness of your mother you shall not uncover. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness. The nakedness of your father's wife you shall not uncover. It is your father's nakedness." By the way, notice that. What is the father's nakedness? His wife. Uh-oh. Hey, wait a moment. We look at Genesis, and who is it that Ham was looking at? Was it Noah, or was it his mother? Notice how the nakedness of the father is the wife being naked. So is Moses being discreet and gentle with his language when he talks about Ham seeing the nakedness of Noah? Now, I said he can be pictured as bringing out his father's garment, but he might have brought out his mother's garment. Notice how Moses has used discreet language, not going into details. But in verse 8, "The nakedness of your father's wife you shall not cover. It is your father's nakedness. The nakedness of your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother," and so on and so on, and goes on and on and on and on. This passage is saying that something is going on with Ham that is reminiscent of the types of problems that were going on planet Earth before God judged the world with a flood. Because through sexual immorality with angelic beings that was happening as they were accumulating harems, it was potentially contaminating the human race and compromising the seed. Now, what happens to the seed of woman promise if the lineage cannot be determined because there is so much promiscuity even within the line of promise? What I'm going to tell you here is, I'm going to give kind of a synopsis of where I see the passage going. The curse that's placed on Ham, and in particular upon Canaan, is saying, guess what? Seed of woman is not coming through this lineage. This is going to be a lineage that is ultimately going to be subservient rather than the lineage through which the Messiah will come. The protection of the Messianic line is going to require purity within the line. The curse that is happening is one that is saying, guess what? This is not the line through which the Messiah will come. The line through which the Messiah will come is through Shem. Now, by contrast, with the disrespect that Moses has not gone into the gory details, he has not told us all of what happened. He has summarized it in such a way that we look at it and we say, okay, something happened. I don't know exactly what happened. He hasn't gone into detail. But what is it that Shem and Japheth do? They take great pains to make sure that they are not looking upon their father's nakedness, whether that's a reference to Noah or whether that's a reference to their mother. And they hid the nakedness of their father. They did not see their father's nakedness. Noah had set up a situation by becoming drunk, and that situation was one that created opportunity for Ham to demonstrate that he was going in directions different than what God wanted. But Shem and Japheth honored their parents, honored the Lord, and took steps to make sure that it could not be repeated by covering this nakedness. In light of the judgment and the reason God had to judge the earth with a flood, God is going to take this very seriously. In verses 24 through 27, we have an oracle that is pronounced by Noah as a result of him discovering what has happened. And so verses 24 through 27, upon waking, Noah learned of Ham's actions. Noah pronounced an oracle, cursing Canaan's son with slavery, but blessing Shem and Ham. Okay, verse 24, upon waking, Noah learned of Ham's actions. Verse 24, so Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him. Now, when it says that he knew, it doesn't say whether he had recollection of what happened to him or whether there was evidence left behind by Ham or whether it was reported to him by his other sons. We're not told how it is that he came to know, but he came to know that this deed has occurred. So he makes a curse, and he makes a blessing. The blessing and the cursing that he makes only have power because God affirms what is said. We know that is the case because God has allowed it to be included in the Bible. God has accepted the pronouncement. So he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brethren. He's going to serve both Shem and Japheth. He is cursed. Now, why isn't it just mentioning Ham? Why does it mention the son? The curse that is happening here is one of exclusion from the lineage through which seed of woman is going to come. Remember, all the genealogies are pointing forward, and each of the Toledot statements, these are the generations of, and remember how we've compared that to saying at a high school reunion, you know what became of so-and-so? When you look at Genesis, do you not get the idea that there's a look down the tunnels of history to the eventual outcome as to how God is going to straighten things out. It's looking down towards the seed of woman. It's looking to the deliverer. It's looking to the one who's going to grant life and to grant blessing. The lineage is getting narrowed. It's gotten narrowed down to Shem being the lineage. But the lineage of Ham, especially through the lineage of Canaan, is going to be under a curse. Why does that really become important to Israel? Because guess who inhabited the land that God was giving to Israel? The Canaanites. And guess where the Canaanites got their name? From Canaan, the son of Ham. And I'll tell you what, I am glad that I did a New Testament PhD. I am glad that I did not do an Old Testament PhD. I don't think I could have handled the reading that Old Testament PhDs have to read. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. You have to know how words are used. And, you know, you look at the Old Testament, you say that's a pretty big book. But really, it's a very small book. And the reason that we call it a very small book is there isn't much else that survives in Old Hebrew. This is the biggest source of Old Hebrew that we have. So how do you define a word when it only shows up one time in the Bible? And there are a whole bunch of those. How do you figure out what a word means that's only used one time? Well, you have to start looking in other languages that are related. Guess what? When you start looking in Ugaritic, and you start looking in Aramaic, and you start looking in all these Canaanite languages, you're basically reading pornography. I mean, in order to learn about the words, you have to read pornography. You have to read all this stuff that's written, all this garbage that's written in these languages, because that's the only kinds of books that survived that they wrote. And you have to study pornography in order to learn what this word means. I mean, it's a really, really strange situation. Old Testament majors, Old Testament doctoral students have to wade through a whole bunch of garbage. Canaanite literature is a cesspool. It is a real cesspool. When you saw that passage in Leviticus chapter 18, it said, there were the practices of Egypt, don't follow those. There were the practices of Canaan, don't follow those. And guess what? You look throughout the Old Testament, and the Israelites were saying, hey, guys, let's go over and start worshiping with the Canaanites. Well, their worship was not anything like a church service. Their worship was orgies. Their worship was in the cesspool. What Noah is saying here in this curse is that he perceives that there is a very strong tendency, and that strong tendency is in him, and he expects it to be in Canaan. The little boy of him. And God has allowed this passage to be here in the Bible because it is, in fact, a statement of what characterized that lineage of Canaan. Now, there has not yet been a time where, in history, they have been a servant of servants to his brethren, but that is something that is yet to come. Verse 26 is the blessing that is pronounced first upon Shem and then upon Japheth. The blessing that is stated upon Shem, and the interesting thing there is that Shem is the word that means name, but blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. Shem's God will be blessed, in part through the subservience of Canaan to his brothers. There is an elevation of Shem, a worshiper of God, who is going to receive subservience from Canaan. Guess what happens when Israel ultimately controls the land? Who is going to be under their dominion? In part, Canaanites. And then verse 27, may God enlarge Japheth. Now, the word Japheth means enlargement. May he allow him to have lots and lots of land, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem. Well, that's telling us that there's going to be territorial expansion, and at times Japheth is even going to encroach upon Shem. But the net effect is that Canaan is going to be his servant. Canaan is going to be in a subservient role. Now, we've talked about Genesis chapter 10 previously. Remember the time that we went through the genealogies and we looked at chapter 4, then we went through chapter 10 and we went through a few other genealogies. The purpose of the genealogy in Genesis chapter 10 is making Israel aware of who they should and who they should not enter into alliance. Should they enter into an alliance with someone who is cursed? No. Should they enter into an alliance with someone from the line of Shem? Yes. That is allowable. And even on occasion, to enter into alliance with descendants of Japheth, but with the understanding that Japheth is going to enlarge his territory and he's going to be wanting to encroach upon Shem, even taking over land of Israel. But Moses is writing Genesis, and let's look a little later in this book to see how Abraham treats the Canaanites, and how he treats Melchizedek, whose lineage is not told to us. Genesis chapter 14, this is when Abram rescues Lot. Look at the dealing with Melchizedek. After the alliance that results in the deliverance of Lot has been accomplished. Verses 18 and following. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, he is the king of Jerusalem area, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he gave him a tithe of all. And it's Abram that's giving a tithe to Melchizedek, recognizing Melchizedek's close relationship with the Lord. Okay. We're not told the lineage of Melchizedek, but Abram is comfortable entering into an alliance with Melchizedek. But what about Melech Sodom, king of Sodom? Melech means king. Notice in verse 18, Melchizedek, king of Salem, Melech of Salem, king of Salem. Well, now we have the Melech, the king of Sodom. And he's a Canaanite. Verse 21, Now the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons and take the goods for yourself. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord, the God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich, except only what the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men who went with me, and their names, let them take their portion. Abram is free to enter into a covenant with Melchizedek. He is not free to enter into covenant with the king of Sodom. The pronouncement is made that Lot really should not have been in the alliance with Sodom, that he was in with them. And you remember the debauchery that attempted to be foisted there in Genesis chapter 9 with the Sodomites. Well, let's look ahead and let's see how Moses practices this. And we've looked at these passages earlier. I'll bring them to your recollection. But isn't it interesting what happens in Numbers chapter 20, verse 14? Now Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Those are Gentiles, aren't they? Edom, that's not Israel. That's the descendants of Esau. Thus says your brother Israel. Guess how it is that they're able to call Edom brother? Based on the table of nations, based on these are people, these are descendants of Shem. They are ones that they are free to enter into an alliance with. Thus says your brother Israel, you know the hardship that has befallen us, how our fathers went down to Egypt, and we dwelt in Egypt a long time. And the Egyptians afflicted us and our fathers. When we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent the angel and brought us up out of Egypt. And now we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your border. Please let us pass through your country. We will not pass through fields or vineyards, nor will we drink water from the wells. We will go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or to the left until we have passed through your territory. And they are denied permission. But they said, we're free to enter into an alliance. They didn't say, okay, it's time to go to war with these people. They said, let's make an alliance. Let's make a treaty. We want to pass through. We'll give them guarantees. These were people that they were free to make treaties with. Would it be fair to make a treaty and then turn around the next day and destroy them? No. God wouldn't let them make treaties with the people they were supposed to destroy. They were allowed to make a treaty. Table of Nations, Genesis chapter 10, tells what nations they can enter into covenant with. Same thing happens with Moab. And so let's look at chapter 21 of Numbers, Numbers 21, 21. Now, verse 21 might sound a little puzzling because Amorites are not descendants of Shem. They are Canaanites, and they're under the curse. But let's look at this. Hold judgment on that. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, let me pass through your land, we will not turn aside, so on and so forth. Sounds like what they said to Edom, doesn't it? Now, the reason that they were allowed to enter into that is because of what verse 26 says. Heshbon was the city of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken all his land from his hand as far as the Arnon, that is the Arnon River. Basically, what's happening is they can enter into a covenant with a Canaanite who's the king over a big population of people who have descended from Shem, Because if they have a war, guess who's going to get killed? The descendants of Shem. So they said, we don't want to enter into war because we know that almost all the people here, except the army, are descendants of Shem. Moses knows who he can enter into a covenant with and who he has to fight against. You remember all the problems that happened in the Old Testament with Gibeonites? Remember them? Okay, let me refresh your memory. There was this time that Joshua was approached by these people who came in old, dusty, raggy clothes and old, musty, moldy bread. And they came and said, we've traveled from a long way. Could we please enter into a treaty with you? And Joshua forgot to consult the Lord. Said, sure. Then they found out, oh, they just came from the hill, just a few miles away, and they were Canaanites, and they weren't supposed to be into a treaty with them. But since the treaty was made, they had to honor it. And God held them to it. And there was a point where King Saul turned against the Gibeonites and got into all sorts of problems with the Lord because a promise had been made. What this passage is doing is it's telling us here 4, 5, maybe 6, not many years after God has judged a world that has gone wholesale into debauchery as there is the angelic infiltration, here we have one of Noah's sons in an incident either with Noah's nakedness after Noah became drunk or with Noah's wife after Noah and his wife got drunk. And Noah and God draw the line and say, Ham, you've got a son here, and his lineage is going to be under a curse. Guess how it is that God selected the land of Israel to give to the descendants of Shem, to the Israelites. It was to take it away from those who were under a curse. Now, I have made a point, you heard me make a big point about, I believe that Canaan was the eldest son of Ham. Why is this important? Most people, when they look at it, they say, every descendant of Ham is under the curse. And you know what they end up noticing? They notice that one of the descendants of Ham was a man by the name... Well, let's go back to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis chapter 10, verse 6. The sons of Ham were Cush. That's the area of Ethiopia. Mitzrayim, that's Egypt. Put and Canaan. And guess what they say? They say, all of them are under a curse. And guess what they end up saying then as a result? Egyptians, black people, and Canaanites are under curse. But you know what? Noah says Canaan is under a curse. Was there any extension of that to the other sons of Ham? No. When the pronouncement was made, I think that there's a 3 or 4 year old boy, the only son that Ham has. And Noah says, your son here is under a curse. His lineage is going to be excluded from the ownership of the land. And instead of being the owners of the land of promise, they're going to be servants there. And that was a pronouncement that went upon the Canaanites. And it is wrong on this passage to say that the curse went beyond Canaanites. You can see why I think that it's a very important point to note. Canaan was the son who was alive at the time that the curse was made. It was upon his lineage that the curse was made. Noah did not say, and God did not say, all the rest of your unborn children are under a curse. It was the child who was alive. His lineage would be under a curse. What we see in the last two verses of this passage sort of brings it to a close. Noah lived 350 years after the flood, so he lived a total of 950 years. Now, one looks at this and they say, oh, isn't it terrible? God has put all these people under a curse. I want you to think about a woman who didn't start out really well. I bet you have no problem remembering the profession that this woman engaged in when I mention her name. Rahab, the harlot. Where did she live? Jericho. Who inhabited Jericho? The Canaanites. But she delivered the spies, and why did she deliver the spies? She had heard that God was going to deliver the land, push out all the Canaanites, and give it to Israel, and she said, yeah. And as she believed the things that she had heard, her response to having those two spies there was, I'm going to protect them because they are God's people. And I would like for us to finish this by turning to the book of Matthew. Matthew chapter 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac, Isaac begot Jacob, Jacob begot Judah and his brothers, Judah begot Perez and Zerah by Tamar, Perez begot Hezron, Hezron begot Ram, Ram begot Amminadab, Amminadab begot Nahshon, Nahshon begot Salmon, Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab. Boaz begot Obed by Ruth, and so on and so forth, and we come down to Jesus Christ. Wait a moment. I thought if the Canaanites were under a curse, oh, they were condemned forever. No one could ever rise up. Guess what? Jesus has Canaanite blood in him. He's a descendant of Rahab, a Canaanite. The curse was a curse that said the lineage that God was going to select, the male lineage, was going to go elsewhere, and Canaan was not going to be the possessor long-term of its land. And It doesn't say that Canaanites couldn't become believers. It doesn't say even Canaanites couldn't be part of the Messianic line through a proper marriage into the line by a believing Canaanite. We look at this passage, it raises a lot of questions, but God is a God of grace. But at the same time, I think we have pretty clear indication as to why it is that the land of Canaan, the land where Canaan dwelt, was that was selected by God to be given to Abraham and his seed. And the Messianic kingdom's capital will be in the land that once was occupied by the Canaanites. Take a guess as to why we have so much problem in the Mideast. The Canaanites want their land, and the Israelites want their land. And that's one of the reasons that it's always a tense place, and it's going to be tense until the Lord sets things up finally to be able to set up his millennial kingdom.